I'm glad you could be back from lunch, and I hope you had a good one. We're on page 463 in Michael Martin's Atheism, a Philosophical Justification. And the only point that I was making at any length before lunch is that when he argues that he's going to define atheism as a lack of belief in God, that his argument for that is contrived and really doesn't show scholarly competence in what he's doing. But now I'd like to go back to that page and just address this issue of how we define atheism, and then also go through the chapter just so we have well in our mind how Martin is using his terms. We always have to do that if we're going to accurately understand an opponent anyway. So we'll try to accomplish both those purposes here. As you know, Martin says that atheism need not be a belief that there is no God, but rather he wants to take it as not believing that there's a God. For anybody who is a little confused by that, I think it's helpful to use an analogy or a parallel. Let's take the English verb to say, or in the past tense, I said. Okay, it's one thing, here's one situation, then here's another. Here's one situation. I did not say I wouldn't go to the movies with you. That's a different sentence from I said I would not go to the movies with you. And we use them in different settings, okay? So let's imagine that you came to where you're supposed to rendezvous with somebody, you're going to a matinee, and they're already gone. And so you go over to the movie theater, and after the movie they look you up, and they're really angry, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they say, well, you said you weren't going to go. And you say, no, I didn't say I wasn't going to go. What you're claiming here is the sentence, I'm not going to go, is not something I said. Now, I could have said, I'm not going to go. That is, I could have committed myself to not going to the movies with you. That would be a different situation. Now, you understand the difference? Not saying and saying that I'm not. If I don't say that I'm going to the movies with you, is that consistent with my being committed to not going? Sure it is. One of the reasons I might not say that sentence is because I don't intend to go. But there's a difference between my stating I'm not going and my not stating anything about it. If I don't state anything about it, I still might not be going. Okay, so you have to differentiate, you know, where the negation is in sentences with the verb to say or said. And the same is true with belief or to believe. It's one thing not to believe, and it's another thing to believe not something. Okay. It's difficult to give this kind of illustration because in thinking about it, I'm going to form a belief. But so let me not put it in the first person. I'm going to use Jerry as an illustration here. Okay. There's a difference between my saying that Jerry has no belief about the number of elephants in Africa. Okay? If I say, Jerry does not believe that there are 963 elephants in Africa. That's consistent with him tomorrow looking up some statistic and saying, you know what, I think there are 963 elephants in Africa. I say, oh, you changed your mind, huh? Well, yeah, he changed his mind in that his mind is differently, you know, is different from was the day before, but he didn't change his beliefs. Because in that case, he had no belief about how many elephants there are in Africa. That's different from my saying, Jerry believes that there are not 963 elephants in Africa. Everyone with me? So not believing and believing not are two different situations. Ordinarily, people would think that the word atheist or atheism refers to believing that God does not exist. But our author, and as long as we know about this ahead of time, we can take account of it, our author wants to use atheism in two ways, one weak and one strong. What the conventional meaning of atheism, or the conventional meaning of atheism, he's going to take as positive or strong atheism. Okay? That's the belief that God does not exist. But for those who do not believe that God exists, which is a weaker position, he calls that negative atheism. And all they're saying is, I've not been given sufficient reason to believe, or I have no opinion on the matter. Either one of those. Now, in my debate with Gordon Stein, when he tried to draw that distinction, I pointed out that what he's calling atheism is what is ordinarily called agnosticism. You know, I have no opinion on the matter, or maybe I don't believe anyone can have an opinion on the matter that's rationally formed. That's agnosticism. And that would fit in with the negative or weak sense of atheism that our author is suggesting to us here. Well, I've clarified it. He's clarified it. So why be bothered by it? Why don't we just go on? Well, because I think the way you define things tells you something about a conceptual scheme or an expectation, or in this case, a presumption of who bears the burden of proof. And I think you need to be aware of that. You're not going to be able to take away from him his idea that we have the burden of proof, but we want to keep it in his face at all times, saying, now you're still assuming that we've got to prove our point, you don't have to prove yours, and you've presumed that only by the way you've defined terms. And I want you to stop and think about this. What's the difference between saying, I believe that God doesn't exist, and I don't believe that God exists?
The first one, you have to prove he doesn't.
On the first one, if I believe that he doesn't, I need some evidence for that. And it's standard fare these days to point out that a universal negative cannot be proven in an a posteriori fashion. Okay? On the basis of experience, how could I prove universally there is no God? Let me say, well, I could prove everything I could, you know, possibly examine, and God might be on the backside of the fourth moon of Jupiter. Since I haven't examined the backside of the fourth moon of Jupiter, it's at least possible that God exists, and I haven't encountered him yet. So to say that there is no God is a very strong claim, and atheists usually get hammered about that, that they're claiming too much. In fact, in order to say there is no God, follow this, you would have to be omniscient. But if you were omniscient, you would be God. Therefore, the only person who could say there is no God is God. God would not deny himself, so no one can say there is no God. Pretty nice, huh? Well, he doesn't want to get caught in that kind of trap, obviously. And so it behooves him to water down his definitions. So he's gonna minimize what he has to do. Now what he's saying is, I don't believe that there's a God. Instead of having to show some reason that there is no God, a metaphysical point, this actually shifts it to an epistemological point where I don't have sufficient reason to believe that there's God. I have no justification for believing. Now, other people may believe without justification. He's not saying that failure justification keeps people from believing. But what he's saying is, in terms of his approach to belief, which, as you know, is objective rational belief, if he doesn't have objective rational reason, then he doesn't believe in God. And on that, how could you argue, I don't believe in God? He's saying, well, all I'm saying is I don't have good reason to believe in God. And I say, well, no, you do have good reason to believe in God. He goes, well, then name that tune. You know, it's kind of like if you say that I should, that I'm wrong not to believe, then you have the burden of proof to show me why I should believe. Okay? I tried to be real detailed about this so that you see that the significance here is greater than just, well, he's not using terms in their ordinary way. He has a definite... there's a strategy to this. I mean, he's not being completely neutral and open-minded. What he's saying is, I'm going to always leave the burden of proof on you. Because I'm okay just as long as I'm not being irrational and not believing. And you can't call me irrational for not believing unless you give me a rational reason to believe. So it's very clever. And I'm not saying this, you know, like taking, you know, big credit or pride in this, but I hadn't anticipated that Gordon Stein would try that. But when he did it in the midst of the debate, I immediately said, no, you're trying to shift the burden of proof. And we had talked about before the debate and with the debate folks that there would be no burden of proof in this debate. I can't get into debate strategy to explain that to you. In other words, he was under equal obligation to make his case as I was. He would not win the debate by simply saying you didn't make your case, which in some standard college formats is all you have to do if you're on the negative side. So we had agreed that there was an equal burden of proof. Well, then you come in and he offers this definition. He goes, well, atheist doesn't mean believing that there is no God. It just means not believing that there's a God. And immediately I said, he's trying to get rid of the burden of proof, and that's why I challenged him. Now then. These are not what most people would call prejudiced sources. I have honestly just grabbed them off my reference shelf. Because when we get this lengthy discussion, you know, that makes it look scholarly, that this is the way you should learn to talk, that atheism means simply the lack of belief, not the belief that there is no God. Let's just go to some standard sources. This is the Dictionary of Philosophy by Peter Angelus. Atheism, Greek. Atheos, without God, from ah, not, and theos, God. Hey, he does etymologies too. But he doesn't draw the same conclusion Gordon Stein did. One, the belief that gods do not exist, or God does not exist. Two, the disbelief in any kind of supernatural existence that is supposed to affect the universe. Three, the lack of belief in a particular God. You notice he doesn't even gloss not believing that there's a God. It's always disbelief in the God, the gods, or some supernatural influence. Dictionary of Philosophy and Religion, W. L. Reese. Atheism, from the Greek, ah, not, plus theos, God, the doctrine of disbelief in a supreme being. Disbelief, not lack of belief, disbelief. Sorry, I should have marked these to save time. From the Dictionary of the History of Ideas, Volume 1, on Ignat. Learn to talk. Agnosticism. Agnosticism is a philosophical and theological concept which has been understood in various ways by different philosophers and theologians. He talks about Huxley coining the term. To be an agnostic is to hold that nothing can be known, or at least that it is very unlikely that anything will be known or soundly believed concerning whether God or any transcendent reality or state exists. Well, for what it's worth, I rest my case. Our author is good enough, however, to concede this finally. Okay, after he goes through all this, you turn the page, page 464, the first full paragraph. He says, still, there is a popular meaning of atheism. Okay. Well, once you admit that you've got a popular meaning over here and you have my meaning over here, it's a natural question to say, why are you departing from the standard designation of terms? Why are you not following the popular? It's not as though there's a lot of confusion. You know, sometimes we have to give a more theoretical or precise definition because the way people talk popularly, you know, gives rise to incoherence and all kinds of conceptual perplexity. But that's not the case. I mean, just about anybody who's learned the English language, I think, will tell you what atheist means. Atheist means somebody who doesn't think there's a God. Doesn't think there's a God? He thinks there is no God. Okay? And when you draw that distinction, you say, did you mean you didn't think there's a God, or you think there's no God? You say, oh yeah, I'm an agnostic. I don't think there's a God. But I don't think there isn't a God. I mean, that's just the natural way English speakers do it. Whenever you draw that distinction between not believing, believing not, agnosticism is called the not believing side, and atheism is called the believing not. Okay, I'm not going to belabor because I've already taken more time than I wanted to on other things. I need to hurry along. He tells us that he will use the popular, which we will call the proper sense of atheism. He'll call that positive atheism. And then he points out, this is we were talking about this before the tape was on, and not all of you were back from lunch. You will find, maybe to your irritation, that Michael Martin tends to unnecessarily complicate his presentation with the display of scholarly apparatus and we put it this way and let me put out my premises and all that. Now, there's a place for that. My problem is that it's only about a third of the time that he does it that you really need that. But here he wants to make sure the logic of positive atheism and negative atheism is understood. Negative atheism means not believing that there's God. Positive atheism, believing that there is no God. He says someone who is a positive atheist, is by necessity a negative atheist, but not conversely. All right? If you believe there is no God, you also don't have a belief that there's a God. But if you don't have a belief that God exists, you don't necessarily believe that he doesn't exist. He could have saved us a lot of time and just said, not all agnostics are atheists.
Yeah, right.
Okay. He says, positive atheism denies that one or more gods exist. Negative atheism does not. Why doesn't it deny that one or more gods exist? Because it just doesn't have a belief, or it doesn't believe that there's any basis for believing one or the other of those. And then, although I don't like these opening two pages for the attempt to shift the burden of proof and the departure from our ordinary ways of speaking, from this point on, I think we should give high marks to Dr. Martin for making it very clear, at least for those people like himself who got to the age of 19 and never went to church, that there are different concepts of God, so that when you mean there is no God, you can mean different things by that. Because from one perspective, I'm a Christian, I'm an atheist, right? If you were a real narrow and harsh Muslim, you could say my belief in Jehovah, by which I've clarified that Jehovah is not Allah, means I'm an atheist, because the only true God is Allah. All right. So he gets into atheism broad and narrow. He says it's useful to distinguish different concepts of God that have played a role in the traditional controversies and debates. I'm on 464, a little below the middle. In modern times, theism has for the most part come to mean a belief in a personal God that takes an active interest in the world, given a special revelation to humans. So understood, theism is contrasted with deism, the belief in a God that is not based on revelation, but on evidence from nature. I would have been inclined, if I were giving you an outline or a branching tree for these different concepts, I would have been inclined to say that deism and theism are not set against one another, but that you have theism, and then you have the deist version of that, which says we don't need supernatural revelation or verbal revelation, and then you have more traditional Christian theism, which believes you have nature and scripture and so forth. So I'm just pointing this out for you. He's not using the terms the way you might have been inclined to do here. He is saying that theism stands apart from deism. And then he brings in polytheism and pantheism. Okay, so deism, polytheism, pantheism. Theism, as traditionally understood, conflicts with polytheism. Okay? Because as traditional understood, there's one God. It also conflicts with pantheism, because this one God is thought of as separate from what we call the created order, whereas pantheism doesn't draw that creator-creature distinction.
So you're saying monotheism?
Did I say deism?
No. No, I'm sorry, sir. You're saying those are the same terms, monotheism?
Yes, theism and monotheism in popular designation are the same, and he seems to grant that. In fact, after he goes through all this, maybe I should just jump to the end so you know that this is not altogether life and death. At the very end, 476, he says, in view of the fact that the controversy between atheist and non-atheist in Western society has usually been about the question of whether an all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful being exists, there is good reason to limit the discussion to atheism in the narrow sense. And so he is going to, in the end, be willing to say that when he talks about God, he's talking about a monotheistic Judeo-Christian concept of God. And then he tells us again, belaboring the obvious, what would be compatible with negative theism and what wouldn't. The only reason I think it's worth your looking at this material is that it is kind of fascinating that if you take atheism as not believing in God, that if you take it in that way, there are various things which you might have associated with the theistic approach which you could still have, and vice versa. I also think it's worth noting that before we get to alienated theism, page 465, he's already said that negative theism in its most fundamental sense means an absence of belief in any god or gods, not just the absence of belief in a personal god. So now he wants to distinguish between the broad sense of negative theism, negative atheism. The broad sense is no gods whatsoever. The narrow sense is I have no belief in the monotheistic Judeo-Christian god. And then he tells us there's a great complexity and variety of positions an atheist can hold. And the first one that is mentioned here is fascinating, what he calls alienated theism. He's going to be willing to take as an atheist someone who says God does exist. And by refuse to believe, that means I refuse to live that. I will not give in. I will not submit. I will not bow the knee. So that is a kind of an alienated theism. But from our standpoint, as believers, when we see somebody who refuses to submit to Jehovah, we'd say he's an atheist. But it's alienated theism. Now, I have a question for you all. I've been doing a lot of talking. Is Michael Martin an alienated theist?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, I believe you could argue both ways without conflict. It all depends.
No, but by the definition we spoke of earlier, having an innate knowledge of transcending God, yes.
Okay, so in the sense that he does believe in this God, but he absolutely refuses to give in to God, he's an alienated theist. But if you mean by an alienated theist someone who, in the dramatic sense of the literature, says, yes, I know there's God, but I hate you and I refuse to submit to you, he's not an alienated theist because he will never admit that there is a God. Okay? So we keep that profession and internal belief distinct. And then on page 466, this is kind of interesting, the way he handles the term agnosticism. He says, in common understanding, agnosticism is contrasted with atheism. Well, why don't we just leave it at the common understanding? Why don't we just go on now? In the popular sense, an agnostic neither believes nor disbelieves that God exists, while an atheist disbelieves. And so he says, in the popular sense, agnosticism is compatible with negative atheism. Well, I've covered this ground. Let me restate that. What you call negative atheism is what we call agnosticism. But here he's laying out all the logical relations. He's being real philosophical about this, you know. And then in 467 he says, well, putting aside the current popular sense of the term agnosticism, putting aside the current popular sense of the term, agnosticism was coined by T.H. Huxley in 1869. And now he's going to show you what Huxley meant by the term. And this would be a good test of your philosophy of language. Is it relevant to the meaning of agnosticism how Huxley used the term, even if he's the one who coined it?
Only if you do it on historical analysis.
Yeah, well, but if you do it historically, what you're saying is here's this variety of beliefs. Now, in terms of the meaning of a term, we usually look at ordinary language and common parlance. But here he's trying to get away from that. He's saying, I'm going to let Huxley define the term as he did. Well, as long as you know that's what he's doing. But that's not what most people mean by an agnostic. Huxley basically means an agnostic is somebody who won't believe anything or won't believe to any degree of confidence other than what the evidence will warrant by rational investigation. He says it's the method that sets forth this principle. Follow your reason without other considerations. The only thing you consider in what you will believe is where your reason takes you. And now he says, it should be clear that agnosticism understood in this way does not entail atheism, even of a negative sort. He says, only if the existence or non-existence of God was not capable of proof would it entail that. Certainly some agnostics have intended more by agnosticism than simply a methodology. On this view, an agnostic is someone who neither believes nor disbelieves that a god or gods exist, since their existence or non-existence cannot be proved by reason. Then in the last paragraph he says, according to some dictionary definitions, an agnostic is a person who claims one cannot know whether God exists or not. He says, in this sense, last line, it's compatible with either theism or atheism. That is the view that says you shouldn't take any leap of faith. Okay, I understand how he uses the term. I think you do too. But aren't you a bit perplexed? Dr. Bahnsen believes that the existence of God can be rationally proved. I hope you're not perplexed by that. But aren't you perplexed that given the fact that I believe the existence of God is rationally provable, that I'm an agnostic on some definitions of the term agnostic? That just seems very bizarre. Okay? Since I believe that reason is a reliable guide and that people shouldn't go outside of the realm of reason to settle the God question, on his methodological definition, I'm an agnostic. Well, you begin to see that the conceptual framework is a bit skewed when you get those strange combinations, I think. Atheism and skepticism. He says, a religious skeptic questions whether one can have knowledge about religious claims, such as God exists. Understood in that way, skepticism is compatible with theism and does not entail negative atheism. For theists might not claim to have knowledge that God exists. They might say only that they have faith that God exists. Okay? So if I say, I believe in God, but I don't know for sure, I'm a skeptic. I know how to use the term. I'm just trying to display for you. Don't you feel uncomfortable with that? Somebody who could stand up and say, and I'm willing to die for this belief. I am absolutely committed. I believe God exists. Point the guns at me. I won't deny it. Of course, I don't think I can rationally prove it, but I won't deny it. They say, oh, you skeptic. That's just a strange way of using it, okay? However, you can use skepticism in that sense, a person who doesn't believe that you can prove this. Ordinarily, a religious skeptic, I'm talking about now common parlance, would be identical with a religious agnostic. The skeptic is someone who says you can't prove it one way or another, which is what we mean by agnostic.
Dr. Bonson,
go ahead.
Isn't he just going through with the way he started with defining atheism with every other term afterwards, redefining it in terms of his own?
Some of the terms he takes in the common way, some of the terms he goes to a historical definition rather than the current common sense way, and some of them he just tries to regiment with his previous definitions. Yeah. So you have to be careful that you not automatically assume you know what you're talking about when you see him use these terms. You might have to check the back of the book and see what he thinks the logical relations are for these things. Now, rationalism is interesting, and I think he did a fairly good job of laying out the possibilities here. In the middle of page 468, he says, perhaps the best known use of rationalism is as a popular rather than a technical term, and it stands for an anti-religious and anti-clerical movement that stressed historical and scientific arguments against theism. And for 20th century Christians, it's probably good to point that out. That is, as I see it, an accurate assessment, especially of 17th through 19th century philosophy. Many times, rationalism did not necessarily connote what we take by it as someone who affirms the autonomy of the mind because there is no God and is a naturalist. The rationalist, many people were called rationalists who were Christian believers because that being anarchistic with respect to church government and anti-Roman Catholic, they were against the clergy in France, for instance. And so they were aligned with the rationalist in that sense. The anti-religious side of this, what he means by that is stressing historical and scientific argument rather than special revelation. So that someone who says, I can know something about God, but it's not based upon special revelation, could, on this term, be a rationalist. He's a rational believer in God. He's a rationalist and a believer in God. Yes, it wouldn't define, but that understanding of rationalism tends to move in the direction of the evidentialist conception of apologetics. In fact, you'll see this if we read on. He says at the bottom of the page, this use of rationalism leaves open the question as to whether a rationalist is an atheist, for a deist is a rationalist in this sense of the term. And so the evidentialist is like saying, I can meet the deist on his own ground. Okay? Where the deist comes to a rational conclusion without Jesus being the Son of God, I'm going to use the same method as the deist but prove that Jesus is the Son of God. So they would both be rationalists, but they've come to different rational conclusions. All right, now at the top of 469, this becomes more important for our purposes. He says, they have not only believed that reason should be used in contrast to revelation and authority in religious context, but they have also thought that if reason was used, it would not establish that any gods exist. So rationalism is the view that you should use reason in contrast to revelation and authority. And what I put in my margin here is such reason doesn't function in any context. So stop and think about this. Such reason, that is reason in contrast to revelation and authority, doesn't function in any context. And that's why I'd be willing to say I believe in a rational proof of God's existence, because reason requires God's existence. It's a precondition of the intelligibility for the use of reason. Now, what do you think would happen if Michael Martin and I were to get into a debate then, and all of a sudden he starts throwing around the relationship of faith and reason to one another? Well, we're going to start talking past each other if someone doesn't say, wait a minute now, I'm not buying your conception of what reason or rationalism is. In fact, what you define as rationalism, the function of reason in contrast to authority or revealed authority, I would argue doesn't exist at all. You're talking myth now. These are storybook tales. They're not talking about the world. Now, you would expect that kind of thing would have to take place, because I'm going to say it's rational to be a Christian, but I don't mean rational in this sense at all. I'm belaboring this for a couple of reasons. First of all, those of you who have heard my dialogue with George Smith, who is cited a number of times in here, may remember that a good portion of that came down to his saying that faith goes beyond reason, and that's why you can't, you know, believe in God. And I said, George, you don't understand. In our view, it isn't that faith goes beyond reason, it's that reason is based on faith. And, of course, you weren't in the studio to see it, but you could probably tell just by the tone of voice and what he said thereafter. This totally stymied him. It was just kind of like, wait a minute, that won't compute. What do you mean reason is based on faith? No, reason is the platform we all have, and then some of you think you can go beyond that platform and have faith. I said, no. My view is there is no reasoning apart from faith in this God. And, of course, the natural response is, well, but unbelievers reason. To which the answer is, I guess they're not really unbelievers then, are they? They profess unbelief. We keep coming back to that over and over again. So I hope you're learning what presuppositionalism is all about. But if you don't look at the way the terms are being defined, you see how easily you could be your position can be trumped intellectually, because you have to watch out for this. I want to say that I am a rationalist when it comes to religion. If you mean by rationalist somebody who says this shouldn't be on a leap of faith but on the basis of good reasoning. I also want to say that there's no such thing as rationalism if you mean reason that functions against revelation or authority or in contrast to. Now, a couple of you have wanted to say something, and I kept going.
I have a question about rationalism. Is this Locke, Hume, and Berkeley's definition of rationalism? And if that so wasn't Locke and Berkeley, weren't they Christians? And did they believe in this way?
Yeah, let me try to lay this out for you. In the history of philosophy, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume were not rationalist in the narrow sense of a school of epistemology that addresses whether things can be known apart from observation. The rationalists believed things could be known apart from observation, like the truths of mathematics. The empiricists, who are then not rationalists, believe everything is based on observation and that there are no general classes but only particulars of things, okay? In that sense, Hume was not a rationalist. More broadly, if you take rationalism to mean what the top of 469 is saying, reason used in contrast to revelation, then the rationalist on the continent, like Spinoza, as well as the empiricist in Great Britain, were rationalists. Have I confused you all? In the broad sense of using man's mind as the final authority, rationalism and empiricism are rationalistic. But now I'm going to confuse you even more. Because even though Descartes was a rationalist in the broad and the narrow sense, he believed in God.
He
believed he could prove God. Right. Spinoza, who most of us would consider an atheist and a naturalist because he was a pantheist, am I losing you yet? He believed that you could call it God, you could call it nature, you're referring to the same thing under different modes of expression. And so he also thought rationally you could prove God exists. But the God that he thought he could prove is not at all like the God that Descartes felt he could prove. And so you've really got to be careful. This term rationalism or rationalist has been used in so many different ways. Hume is not a rationalist, but he is a rationalist. He's not a rationalist in the Descartes sense or the Cartesian sense, but he is a rationalist in the sense that he trusts his own reasoning authority rather than revelation. And Hume concludes there is no God. On the other hand, John Locke, who is not a rationalist but an empiricist from whom Hume got his premises, John Locke believed that God very probably does exist. And Berkeley, who is the other empiricist, of course that throws people because he was also an idealist, Berkeley didn't just think it was probable, he thought the proof of God's existence was inescapable. Because if God didn't exist, then things would disappear when we weren't looking at them. So it's quite a toss-up. Little history of philosophy here. Rationalism, as we use it in modern evangelical circles, I'm defining very exactly, the popular designation or parlance in our circles, a person's a rationalist if he rejects revelation and trusts his own reasoning in its place. Okay? So now earlier I said Dr. Bonson believes there's a rational proof for God's existence. Am I a rationalist? Tell me the ways in which I am. Tell me the ways in which I am not a rationalist. Anybody?
You're not a rationalist.
You believe in revelation, so you're not.
Okay, so I believe in revelation. In that sense, you'd say, I'm not a rationalist.
That's what I'm going to say. It's not an atomic rationalist.
So okay, this is going to help.
Reason as a tool
should be applied to the revelation.
Right, so but I believe that we should make up our minds on these things rationally, not by a leap of faith or emotionally and so forth. In that sense, I'm a rationalist, right?
But also, in using the transcendental argument, argument.
The transcendental argument, in fact, is an appeal to people's reasoning. But it's not an appeal to their autonomous reasoning. It's an appeal that there is no autonomous reasoning. So you may just keep going back and forth here. But I think by doing this, you've all learned something about, one, what the claim is and how the claim is supported, and then how to be careful not to get confused with people.
When you say that an unbeliever who is reasoning shows that he really is a believer even though he denies it, the object of his belief, how do we know it's the God of the Bible and not an impersonal reason with a capital R?
Romans 1.
Well,
is before God.
I just want to pick up all these remarks for the tape. Romans 1 is the most obvious answer, and then you were adding.
I was saying that I was just trying to clarify what you were saying to myself, in that there's like reason is beyond God, and then God is kind of submitted to reason. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think what he's
like,
saying is
good.
Why does it have to be Jehovah that's the object of their belief in order to engage in reasoning? So that is, maybe the transcendental argument only shows that there's got to be some supernatural agent of unity in the universe. And it doesn't have to necessarily be Jehovah. And the answer to that is, one, that there is no other God that could be the object of this, according to Romans 1. And then here's my rational argument as well. I'm not going to develop it, but here's the map for it, the outline. Any other alternative that's presented can itself have an internal critique done of it to show that it will not match up to the demands, so that there's only one God that will do this, and that's Jehovah, as revealed in the Bible. And it's also good to remember, we may not come back to this a lot in the course, so I'll take this opportunity to stress this, that transcendental presuppositionalism is not arguing for God in the abstract, or even that amount of God that can be known apart from special revelation, as though we were just more faithful in our deism than other people. You have to understand that we don't build up our worldview piece by piece. So that I go argue with Stein, and first I prove that God's needed for the laws of logic. Okay, so I got that much. Now, I go argue with Tabish, and I show that God is necessary in order to have scientific inference. And then I add that much. And so now my worldview is being built up. As each one of these arguments goes, piece by piece by piece by piece, as Dr. Van Til teaches us in modern epistemology as well, you don't build up your worldview piece by piece by piece by piece. It's all clusters. And so we start with a cluster of beliefs. Now somebody might say, what justifies them? I say, what justifies them is that without them you can't justify anything. And somebody might say, well, I don't think you need all those things in that cluster. I say, well, it's not for you to say what's needed in the cluster. I got this cluster from the Bible. And by the way, the internal logic of the Bible is I can't throw any of it out. So believe it or not, this is going to sound strange. Don't reject it right away. What the Bible teaches us about Gideon is necessary for you to use the laws of logic. Necessary in the sense that you cannot have a complete demonstration that allows for the laws of logic, which will not include premises that entail what the Bible says about Gideon. Okay. Why? First of all, because not just any God will do for logic, science, human dignity, moral absolutes, human freedom, on and on and on. Only the God that reveals himself in the Bible will do. Now, if that much is shown, and I'm doing this real quick, I mean, take weeks to get an atheist to even let you have the time to go through all the arguments. But now, if you get that far, the point is that God, which is known because he's revealed himself in the Bible, also says in the Bible, Scripture cannot be broken. And so if I'm right that the laws of logic require this God, and this God's word entails whatever is said about Gideon is true, then it turns out by transition that if what the Bible says about Gideon is not true, then this God hasn't revealed himself in the Bible, in which case the laws of logic don't have a precondition of intelligibility. And so I know that throws people at first, but you have to remember that I've had people in academic settings advise me, and it's like they're trying to help this poor, demented Sunday school child out. And they'll say, well, now, you really don't want to say it's the whole Bible you're defending. I said, no, it really is what I want to say. No, because wouldn't it be a lot easier just to trim this down, you know, to like the bare bones? You want to say that there's a personal God who created the world and all that. That's just enough, because you're going to have to prove everything in there. But my answer is no, I don't have to prove everything in there, because if my principle is correct, then everything in here must be true. And it's that principle that I'm going to argue with you. Okay, I think most of you are on to that by now. Here's what I don't want you to miss. That none of us can justify knowing that principle apart from the revelation of God in Christ. I can defend it without mentioning Jesus, because our arguments don't always get into everything. So, in the case of Gordon Stein, I didn't try to show that only if we know God through Christ can we have that principle that saves logic. But that is part of my worldview. In fact, it's also part of our experience. Because as it turns out, none of you could come up with this conception of God, the triune God whom Jehovah is, just by starting from scratch and saying, well, here's what I know about the world. What are the preconditions of intelligibility? Da 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 da. It doesn't work that way. In fact, I'm waiting for the day I can have one of these public debates with an atheist where we can get into something this deep. Because the real question is, well, if Jehovah is necessary for logic, and let's grant that for argument's sake, why do people make mistakes about this? Why doesn't everybody just naturally and instinctively follow Jehovah then? And what's the answer? The only adequate answer is because we've rebelled against him, and the rebellion brings, as a consequence, intellectual darkening. And being in the dark, let me play with the metaphor, being in the dark, men end up going all kinds of weird ways philosophically because they're in the dark. Now, what accounts for that? I don't know if any of you have gotten so far in your apologetical development that you see that the fact of intellectual disagreement and sin is itself an argument that leads to Christianity. because let's say I was a follower of Spinoza. Okay. Given much of what Spinoza says, no one should ever make any mistakes. He has such a rational conception of the universe and of man, there should be no mistakes. And so Spinoza, he was a good enough philosopher to realize this, he says, I've got to give some account for intellectual error. How is it even possible? And so he ends up saying something which is really cheesy, but nevertheless he's trying to answer the question. It's not even answered by Michael Martin and others. Spinoza says, well, error must be confused ideas, by which he means error is really truth, but inelegantly stated, you know, stated kind of in a sloppy way. That in fact, everything we believe must be in some measure true, but if we get a little confused in its expression, then we call it error. Okay, now I don't buy that, and we don't have to worry about refuting Spinoza, but what's fascinating is he realized that if I have a rational conception of the universe, why do people make mistakes? And this is, you know, a good challenge from the Christian standpoint. We say, we've got an answer. The reason why people are in the dark and there are all these mistakes is because in rebelling against God, we can't find our way back to the transcendental. We can't find our way back to how we know humans are dignified and that there are moral absolutes. We find that we can't live without those beliefs, and that we can't justify them apart from what turns out to be Jehovah of the Bible. So now how are people who are, quote, in the dark, going to finally get to the transcendentals that give meaning and rational justification to the way we live our lives? Well, you know the biblical answer, and it's hard for tears not to come to my eyes. That's how good God is. God sent his Son to pursue us, to say, here's the way home, fellas. You're in the dark, you're lost. Of course, he did more than that. He also paid the price of our guilt and all that. But you see, the work of redemption is what enables us to find the transcendentals. And so I can argue only about the transcendental side of it, but that's only because we've abstracted from the picture the fact of sin. If I could have had, I'm just, you know, being theoretical here. Hypothetically, if I could have 3 more hours with Gordon Stein, I would have said, and now that we understand this, the question is, how did we all get so messed up, Gordon? And what are we going to do about that? Why is it, if God is the transcendental of meaningfulness and there is logic, that we act illogically? And why didn't we know this? Why didn't we willingly admit this all along? And so you are forced, what I'm saying is the transcendental presuppositional argument is more than just those surface illustrations of what's wrong with the unbelieving worldview. If you pursue it further, you integrate yourself further into the worldview, you find out you couldn't know even this much if Christ had not redeemed us. Okay, so now my point was from way back when. Don't forget that we're arguing the entire Christian worldview, not just some abstract foundation for logic, foundation for science. We end up talking about one thing at a time, abstracted from the whole context. But the Christian argument is you have to have the whole enchilada, or you haven't got anything. And that includes redemption. So we are not just deists with better arguments. We have a redemptive approach even to philosophy. Okay, go ahead. All of you who've been patiently waiting, back here than here.
I've heard that there's a distinction between psychological and intellectual objectivity. If I understand you correctly, you say there is no distinction because sin marks even the intellectual objectivity.
Well, let's ask what intellectual objectivity would be without bringing in psychological objectivity.
That we can, we have to interpret some data, right? And we could interpret data, let's say, according to a view of science or some such thing.
Well, I would have taken intellectual objectivity, isn't that the term you used?
Yes.
I would have thought that meant that the truth is a public matter and it doesn't vary from person to person. So that intellectual objectivity means the rejection of subjectivism. And then psychological objectivity, those who affirm it would be those who say that though we're all subjective in our thinking, we can be neutral in our approach to the public information that's out there. And I would affirm, if I've used the terms properly, that's why I ask you, I do affirm the truth is objective. And I'm adamant that no one can get to the truth objectively. Okay? But nevertheless, the truth is objective. And what you will find out is if you pursue this with a guy like Michael Martin or anybody else, we as Christians have a different concept of objectivity than he does. In the end, our view of objectivity is the God's eye point of view, to put it in a pedestrian fashion. The way God sees things is that which is not affected by contingency and variation and personal prejudice and bias and short-sightedness and all that. That which is truly public and objectively true is what God says. And from our perspective then, everybody else is pursuing subjective prejudices. Only those who believe God and follow Him according to His Word are objective in what they are saying. The irony is, and this is not just the debater's trick, it's very significant in terms of worldviews. The irony is, most people would say, if you're following the Bible, you're not being objective. That's not objective. And that's because objectivity is understood by them as meaning autonomy. But we don't believe there is any autonomy. So if we took their view, we'd have to say there's no objectivity either. And that's what you want to do when you argue with people like that. You want to drive them to see that their concept of autonomy destroys objectivity. Okay. Oh, here.
Yeah, when you were talking about the fact that there's no way we can see the transcendentals apart from God's grace through revelation.
Now that we're in sin.
That we're in sin.
Right.
Reminded me that as I was reading the case against Christianity and reading his fractured and misinterpreted understanding of scriptures, that the scripture that kept going through my mind the whole book was that the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see.
Right.
Therefore necessitating God's revelation as the only way to see that.
Well, in a sense, you are enriching the point that I'm making. This is very valuable. I said you can't even understand the transcendentals unless you look at the entire worldview and account for what? The fact of error and disagreement and sin. And that means the only way we can really get to the transcendentals is if we also have a view of human nature that takes care of the sin problem, and that's why redemption is necessary even to work out completely our arguments for logic and science and so forth. Now what you're adding is that when we look at the way unbelievers operate, and the systematic distortions and the way they're suppressing the truth and so forth, it's obvious that no one is ever going to accept what I've just talked about as a Christian worldview until their heart has changed. Okay. Now, does this mean we shouldn't use the arguments because they don't do any good until a person's heart has changed? No, those are two different issues. The Holy Spirit's got to subjectively change the rebellious opposition of the unbeliever. But even when the rebellious unbeliever is not willing to cry uncle and admit he doesn't have the preconditions of intelligibility for logic and science and morality, for the glory of God and the truth, we still have to point out to him the argument, which hopefully shuts his mouth, not literally, but I mean, leaves him nowhere to stand. You say, well, you may not want to submit, but when you don't submit to this God, you're giving up objectivity. You're giving up human dignity, you're giving up logic, you're giving up science, and so forth. You have no right to use these. And we can press that argument, and I think from an argument standpoint, not subjectively, argumentatively, we can rationally prove that. We can say what you're talking about in terms of a random universe does not comport with a universe where there's regularity and abstract universal laws. Now, a person like Gordon Stein would say, yeah, well, I still do balance my checkbook. And I say, yeah, that's because the universe that you profess to believe in is not really the one you believe in. As long as you're balancing your checkbook, you're borrowing from God's universe. The worldview that I profess, you're also working in terms of, and the difference between us really is that God has brought me to the point of confessing that truth, and you haven't been willing to confess it. Okay? Yeah.
It reminded me of the first time I read Van Til's Paul at Athens. I used to read that passage and not understand it at all. And the fact is that what you were talking about, you bring the whole picture into the debate.
Right.
That you can't stand apart from anyone. And then you mentioned groping in the dark. Well, no aspects there. Paul preaches Mars Hill, the whole concept.
That's right. That's right. Thank you.
That's what needs to be challenged.
Yeah, as though they were groping, Paul says. That's exactly right. I just thought of another way I might express part of what we've been discussing. I know that atheists cannot be open-minded and try really to get into the debate for the sake of the truth of the matter. We know that that isn't the way unbelievers are. But on a hypothetical reconstruction of a discussion, an atheist who follows my transcendental argument to a certain point, you know, where he says, wow, I guess you're right. You would have to have God to have logic. You'd have to have God to have science. You'd have to have God to have morality. An intelligent atheist at that point ought to, if he knows how you use rational and irrational principles in a debate, he ought to reverse on me right away and say, you're doing so good explaining the rational side of things. Here's what's wrong with it. It's too neat. It's too neat. Because on your view, people shouldn't be making mistakes. On your view, everybody should believe in God quite naturally and so forth. He should immediately say, well, then why are we all disagreeing? Why is there any reason to debate? This is just too neat, Dr. Bonson. But of course, hypothetically, if you could get him that far and then he realized, uh-oh, I've got to, and here's a good argument, that's just too good a thing, then he's going to throw that out, and that's opening the door to me to say, that's right. It is too neat, because the thing we haven't talked about yet is sin and rebellion. And you're never going to get to the place where you can make good use of this information until your problem with sin and rebellion has been dealt with. Most unbelievers honestly think, they're wrong, but they honestly think that there's a difference between their intellect and the way they behave. So that they think they can behave perfectly all right, even though they're intellectually messed up, or vice versa. But from the biblical perspective, we know you can't have intellectual purity without behavioral purity, and you can't have behavioral purity without intellectual. So that, in, I told you a minute ago, my little illustration was contrary to the facts about human nature. I said, what if I could get an atheist to finally admit the transcendentals, and then he could say, oh, well then why is it everybody doesn't believe? And I'd bring in the fact of sin. The fact of the matter is, he'll never get to that point because of the fact of sin. Sin will keep him from ever, and you'll see this, I think I saw it in Tobish, maybe even externally. You see it in Michael Martin. He comes right up against transcendental arguments and veers just like that away. It's almost like, uh-oh, too close to something that I don't like. And he doesn't ever give an honest answer. In fact, one of the most devastating transcendental arguments, we're going to have to finally get to it in detail, he dismisses in one sentence. And it's almost like he almost stepped over the line, but now we're not going to get into that kind of stuff. And that's because when we look at the entire Christian worldview, we also have to bring in the fact of sin. And that's why it's never deistic presuppositionalism that we can collapse into. It's always redemptive, transcendental presuppositionalism. Everybody with me? Let's all say that now three times. Now. Redemptive, transcendental presuppositionalism. Exactly.
Dr. Bonson, can you
go ahead.
Let's say that somebody understands that they've lost reason and logic and ethics and so on without the Christian God of the Bible. And let's say they say, okay, granted that you're right, I don't have any argument. And they say, well, somehow it must be true. Is that the point of conversion? Or what's, help me to know faith
no.
versus saving faith and the,
right.
the propositions of the object of the faith.
Okay, let's talk about faith and profession and then distinguish between unsaving faith and profession and saving faith and profession. So how many possibilities do we have here? We have the person who has unsaving faith with no profession. Then the person who has unsaving faith who professes that faith, then we have the person who has saving faith who doesn't profess, and then we have the person who has saving faith who professes. Now, okay. Now, of those, the Bible tells us that anyone who has saving faith who doesn't profess it doesn't really have saving faith. I drew a distinction, but you have to understand that once you come to the saving kind of faith, rather than the suppressed faith in unbelief, you have to profess it because you're saved. Okay? And so it turns out we've got linguistically four categories, but from what the Bible tells us, three and four really turn out to be identical. Okay? So saving faith is also saving profession. You can't have saving faith without professing the faith. Okay? But now on the other side, you can distinguish, because you could have somebody who has faith in this God. In fact, everyone does have that faith. But it's unsaving. It's suppressed in unrighteousness. Okay? And because they suppress it, they're under the judgment and the wrath of God. Romans 1. And now here's the fascinating thing. A person who has unsaving faith in God might, these are very rare cases, might be willing to concede that. And if he's willing to concede it, and maybe even profess it, but will not live in terms of it, he's not saved.
Would that Mortimer have to be one such person?
Possibly. I just don't know enough about his lifestyle and so forth, and all of his conclusions. He's changed over the years, and I don't want to say without more detailed study. But you might have somebody who says, well, I'll give you two examples. You might have somebody who says, I realize that only you Christians can make sense of science. But I hate the way I'd have to live if I were a Christian. I'd have to give up my girlfriends and my drugs and so forth. And so even though I don't have an intellectual answer for you, I refuse to submit. That's one kind. Now, I granted, most unbelievers are unwilling to profess that they know in their heart of hearts. But every once in a while, they might say, hypothetically, I don't have an intellectual answer for you, so you're right, but I'm not going to do it. But there are also people that we know who will say, yes, what the Bible says about God is true, and what it says about Jesus is true, and he's the only way of salvation, and I don't want anything to do with it.
On a practical level, just in dealing with people who are lost, that is the majority of people who are not believers. They'll acknowledge, and then they sit there and do whatever they do. They live in an open rebellion. They don't profess to be.
I don't know whether it's the majority, but I certainly am with you that there are many people. We were talking about this last night, maybe at dinner. There are many people who will say the right words, and yet you look at their lives and you say, this hasn't changed you. There's no repentance. You know, there's no casting yourself upon Christ and his mercy as your only hope in life and death. And so there are rare cases where people even profess the truth and not be saved.
Can you say what the propositions are that you must confess? Is that clear? Is it Jesus is Lord, the person of Christ? Yeah, I think of the thief on the cross that he didn't understand the Trinity. What are the propositions?
Yeah, well, I think we're getting real deep into something which is a great subject. Let me try to wind it up so we can get back to Michael Martin. But any specifications of the general conditions under which a person has to believe things in order to be saved is going to be very dangerous because the conditions are so varied. The thief on the cross is a great counterexample to most attempts to universalize it. So you end up having to say these are the sorts of things that a person must affirm. These are the sorts of things a person must be willing to affirm if you were properly educated and had the opportunity, and things of that nature. So I would say the thief on the cross was a dispositional Trinitarian. Okay? That doesn't mean while he's suffering there in agony, he's thinking through philosophically all the connections. If I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of this person, he must be the Son of God. But if he's the Son of God in flesh, then God must be, you know, tri-personal and all that. Obviously, I don't think that. That's why I said dispositionally. If we could talk to him and ask him these questions, and he could look at the various possibilities. If he has saving faith, he's going to say the right things. He's going to say, yeah, well, he is the Son of God. Okay. Any other questions about this before we close it off and go back to Michael Martin? You all want a break here pretty soon, I know. On page 469, still finishing up his view of rationalism. He says, thus Watts maintains that by the use of reason, one cannot conclude that God either does or does not exist. On this interpretation, a rationalist is a person who believes that only reason, in contrast to revelation, should be used to establish belief about a god or gods, but that reason cannot determine whether a god or gods do exist. And it'd be good if you circled the word cannot. It's easy enough to read that sentence and understand it in the weaker sense, but he doesn't mean it in the weaker sense. You see, cannot doesn't mean we've all used our reason as best we can up to today and no one has been able to prove it. That would mean has not been proven. I can understand somebody, I mean, I don't agree, but somebody might say it hasn't been proven yet. But it's a big step forward when you say not only has it not been proven, it cannot be proven.
But then doesn't
that's
that
exactly
shift
right.
the burden of proof?
What's that?
Doesn't that bring the burden of proof on him when he makes a statement like that?
Uh-huh.
He says it cannot prove it.
Well, I'm so glad you're in this class. Here's the next step. We have an author now who wants to say it cannot be proven.
The other thing I know...
But if he were to make that claim, he would have a burden of proof. But you know what he has done by his definitions? He's assumed that we've always got the burden of proof. And so what he's going to do... I guess we don't need to worry about the rest of this. I wanted to go through it. Let me take you the next step here. What he wants to do is say, if we have not fulfilled the burden of proof, then God cannot be proven. It's just incredible. He says on one hand, he wants to say, there is no burden of proof, and then he acts like since we haven't fulfilled the burden of proof, he can assert that it cannot be known. And then, on top of it, when he realizes, boy, that's going to sound like I've overstated my case, he goes and he admits, we haven't looked at all the arguments. And then he says, but we don't need to look at all the arguments. Well, you got this guy is hopping back and forth from pillar to post. Which is it, you know? And that's why I want you to know what kinds of claims he's making. In
well,
part one, go ahead.
I'm sorry. He's not playing on a level playing field because he says, well, we don't know that someday we might not be able to decide that Christ could have been resurrected by natural causes, but on the other hand, he won't give us the same amount of time to someday find out that there is a God. We may find, science may prove there is a God as well as...
Yes. You go to the head of the class. That is absolutely right. I've noted this in my margins over and over again. In fact, I got so tired of writing it out, I just start using the Latin expression, et tu. Because what he does is, whenever he finds himself in the inductive position
right.
of not having covered everything, he says, but that's okay because we've covered all the important ones, representative, blah, 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 blah. But whenever Christians are faced with, he'll say like, well, there are other ethical theories, and you'd have to refute every one of them before you could say that.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, where's the level playing field?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it we have to refute every single one and every possible one and take account of all the future ones before we can say anything, and yet you turn right around and you say you don't have to complete your induction? Yeah. This is a crucial criticism. I hope you all understand it. We're going to take a break. And then when we come back, what I've done is I've outlined here on this page where he gets into negative criticism what he says he is doing. So I want you to follow this down, you know, just exactly. And by negative atheism, remember he means it is justified not to believe in God. But he's not yet proving that there is no God. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break.